welcome into the latest edition of the show. Kay Murray, Matteo Bonetti, we have Gab Marcotti, Nikki Bandini and Mina Rizzucchi all featuring this week. But before we do hear from them, Matteo, transfer the best business. Let's just get it out the way for you, because we will be talking about it throughout the show. But the best piece of business that you saw in Serie A with this window.
I've been wrecking my head all night about this, and I'm going to go with Napoli's big money acquisition, the $90 million signing from Lille, Victor Osimhen, because of what I think he will mean to the club leading the line. But there were plenty of other candidates. This was a tough one. It was basically a toss-up for me between him and about two or three other players, but I think Osimhen will have the biggest long-term impact. I have loved what I've seen from him in the first few matches.
I'm pretty sure Gab Marcotti will be agreeing with you on this one, but there's a lot more to talk about when it comes to Napoli, and that's why we'll bring Gab in to do so. All right, Gab Marcotti, let's get into the mess that was, or should I say wasn't, Juventus against Napoli. What happened and what the latest is? A recap, if you will, sir.
All right, I'll try to be, it's a horrible, boring story, but I think it's one of those things you kind of have to go through. So basically, the Italian league and the national government, together with a scientific and technical committee, the wise men who tell you how to handle these situations, they established a big detailed protocol of how to keep players safe in these conditions, what you need to do, how you're going to deal with it if there are positive cases and whatever else. But they left out a small detail, or they didn't leave out a small detail. At the same time, the government passed another law, which effectively said that regional local authorities have the ultimate emergency powers to deal with cases of positivity. What happened with Napoli was Zielinski tested positive for COVID-19. And then on Saturday, as literally they got the result as they were on their way to the airport, they had another positive test, Elmas. All of a sudden, it was two of them, and they got advice from the local regional authority in Naples saying, ooh, you've had two positive tests. You really should go and quarantine. Now, under the protocol, there's what they call a soft quarantine, which basically says all the players stay together. They all sequester themselves in a hotel or at the training ground. They can train together. They can play games. They just can't go home to their families. That's what you consider a soft quarantine, and that is what you should do if you have, you know, a small number of positive cases. This is in addition to getting everybody tested and all the other jazz that they do. This is what Atalanta did earlier this year. It's what Milan did earlier this year. It is kind of the reasonable thing to do. For reasons that, to me at least, aren't entirely quite clear, Napoli said, wait, no, we can't self-quarantine. We need to follow these instructions. Let's reschedule the game. And far be it for me to stick up for Juventus and Andrea Agnelli. But when Agnelli got the call, he's like, hang on a minute. We spent all summer working on this protocol, saying how we were going to deal with just this specific situation. All of a sudden, you're telling me that, you know, the regional medical service in Naples trumps what we agreed with the government. No, we're going to show up at the stadium, and if you're not here, you're going to forfeit the match. And the Italian league backed them on this. And so, unfortunately, there's a lot of posturing and a lot of politicking. For me, based on the facts that are available to me thus far, and look, I'm not a doctor, I would kind of say the league and the national government trump a regional medical authority in this situation, and Napoli should have shown up to the game. There are two other theories which, you know, potentially are legitimate. One is they played Genoa the week before, and Genoa, as you guys know, they ended up, I've lost count. It was like just among the players alone, it was 12 cases, 14 cases, 15 cases. You know, they keep increasing. Yes. And so obviously their concern was, well, we played them. What if everybody, you know, has been infected and the cases were just showing up one by one? Yeah. Because obviously they had Zielinski and then Elmas. Now, again, not a doctor, but they have tested these guys repeatedly and they keep testing negative. We'll see where we are now. That's one possibility. The other possibility, which some people raised, is that according to the protocol, after the first Zielinski test, they were supposed to all enter the soft quarantine bubble. In other words, they were all supposed to, as I said, sequester together in the hotel, train there, and travel together to Turin. And by the way, one of the things was One of the ways that the local medical authority in Naples justified it is, as well, it's not just about them, but when they travel, they come in contact with other passengers, ticket agents, and so on. It's not really the case here because they charter a flight, they get off, they get on their own bus. So they are coming in contact with a very limited number of other people. So if they didn't follow those soft quarantine rules to begin with, then potentially they couldn't then do it now, if you see what I'm saying, because they might have it potentially infected family members and other people. But again, we don't know yet because we haven't been party to, we don't even know if this is the argument that's being made.
And just really quickly, and I know that you've said it and I'll say it again, we're not epidemiologists, we're not doctors, but I've done enough reading to understand even the incubation period as well, that the second that you get infected, it's not that you maybe start showing up positive. It could take a day or two. So even the Genoa tests, when we look at them, Gab, there were different positive tests that showed up on different days. The initial report, I think, was 14, and then it went up to 18. And I'm just wondering, and again, it's such an unprecedented time that it's, you know, you're always going to face some sort of problem. But if Napoli had two different players who tested positive on different days, and let's say that they infected someone else, but they only would show positive 2 days after, but that's already the day after they would have played Juventus, this could even potentially be one of the issues or one of the problems, is that you do have different incubation periods for different players. Everyone didn't get infected in the same exact time and are going to show positive at the same exact time. I understand the Juve end, though, because if you allow this precedent that teams and local governments can decide, then, you know, what's Serie A going to look like? We've already had plenty of teams that have had multiple positive tests that have gone on to play. I mean, just look at some of the big teams. Milan had Zlatan Ibrahimovic and Leo Duarte. So this is something that's already happened this season that other teams have been able to get by.
Yeah, and look, I think ultimately it's about managing risk, right? So you have the government and scientists and stuff like that getting together with the league and saying, how are we going to restart this in a way that's viable? Now, obviously, it's possible that, like you said, maybe there's other people who are infected, but they don't show positives yet, and they got on the pitch, and they would have infected Cristiano Ronaldo, and then Cristiano Ronaldo passes out. Like, all of this is possible, right? But these risks are always there. They're always there every time you leave your house. So I'm happy with whatever the rule is, but let's make sure there is one rule and one procedure that everybody has to abide by. Once we agree on that, we're fine. And that's kind of the issue I take here. Napoli agreed to that set of rules. Napoli also have doctors. And, you know, I personally find it surprising that, you know, they said, oh, let's try to get the match postponed, which, by the way, this season, as you know, it's an incredibly compressed season. Postponing matches creates an enormous problem. And, you know, we could talk about, hey, would it have been better if we'd looked at a different format for the league, the season, whatever. I'd say, yeah, I don't think players should play as many matches as they're playing this season. But that's a whole other issue. I mean, I think we need clear rules and we need one set of rules. And to me, again, the rules were pretty clear and Napoli opted to go a different way.
But Gab, let's move on to something that's a bit more interesting now, because obviously we've talked about that. We've exhausted it. I saw your piece on it and the musings on ESPN.com as well. And I know you didn't want to really say who was right and who was wrong, and who wants to get into that. But did Juventus address the areas they needed to before the transfer window closed?
So look, Juventus had a massive handicap going into this window, right? So it's a big, something we've talked about endlessly is, over the past couple of years, they've adopted a very short-termist win-now situation in adding veteran players on enormous wages in free transfers that, you know, aren't free. Because if I sign Aaron Ramsey or Sami Khedira or Emre Can and I end up having to give $15 million or whatever it is to their agent and I have to give them stupid wages, and it's to the point that it becomes impossible for me to sell them, then, you know, I've decided, first of all, it's far from a free transfer. Second of all, I've decided I'm doing this because I want to win straight away. I want to win while I've got Cristiano Ronaldo in the window of opportunity. We can debate another time whether that was the right strategy or not. But having done that, there was only so much they could do, right? So they dumped, they ate Gonzalo Higuain's contract. They ate Blaise Matuidi's contract just to get somebody to cart them away. And they brought them back to Matteo's hometown, as you know. And of course, they'd already committed the Kulusevski money pre-COVID. And I think Kulusevski is the kind of player that can definitely help them, whether we think he fits into Pirlo's system or not. I thought the Morata deal was a good deal. they need another live body in there to run around and play center forward, and Morata's adaptable to that. I think some of the other deals give you a sense of what Juve are like right now in terms of cash flow. Because look, Weston McKennie, it's 3 million euros plus an option to buy next summer, you know, which may or may not happen. The Chiesa deal is different because effectively they've bought him out, right? But on paper, you know, it's a 2-year deal where it only becomes a permanent deal if certain conditions are met. And just to give you a sense of how far out on a limb and what acrobatics Juve had to get into, not because they're bad or stupid, just because of the situation that they're in by overpaying for players before. So they're paying 3 million euros for the first year loan. They're paying 7 million euros for the second year loan. After those 2 years, and you tell me how likely these things are, right? If one of these, just one of these three things happen, then the deal becomes a permanent deal and they have to go and pay another 40 million. So one is that Chiesa gets 10 goals or 10 assists in the 2 years, which I think is pretty reasonable. One is that he plays 60% of the minutes, again, injury permitting, pretty reasonable. The third one is Juve have to finish in the top four in one of those 2 years. Now, I think we can probably assume that they will probably finish top four in at least one of those 2 years. So effectively, they've bought him. Effectively, they're going to pay 40 million in 2 years' time. And then there's another 10 million in bonuses. So I think we can speak of this as a 50 million plus 10 million euro deal. I think he has a big upside. In the immediate, Matteo, I don't know how you feel about it, but I'm not sure where you put him in the lineup, but that's okay. You're accumulating assets here.
I was actually going to go into that because it seems like Juve, they were top heavy in the second match. They seemed a bit unbalanced. They had the wingbacks, Juan Cuadrado on one side, then you have Kulusevski on the other. Juan Cuadrado never played on the left-hand side as a wingback any time in his career, and it seems like this may be the role for him, certainly without Alexandre now, who's injured. But with Federico Chiesa coming in, he played at wingback for Fiorentina, but it's very different now because you have Kulusevski there. Who are you going to take out? Is Chiesa going to get anywhere near the minutes that he got at Fiorentina? Absolutely not. Is it reasonable to have two attackers, basically wingers, playing at wingback? It seems more like a video game formation right now with some of the things I've seen suggested in the Italian media that Kulusevski is now going to play behind Dybala, Ronaldo, with Chiesa on one side and Cuadrado on the other. How's that? That team's really, really top heavy. I mean, that is not a balanced side. That isn't really the Juve that we've seen under any of the previous managers. And it just seems a little bit too extreme in one direction. They're already calling it the most attack-minded Juve of all time, I've seen even in the Gazzetta. But it doesn't really seem like a balanced 11. And that's my issue because I really like Chiesa, but I still think that he has more growing to do. The growing that he has done that we've seen in the last few weeks is in part to all the time that he's been getting. This is a player that has been inconsistent in front of goal, that has several qualities that maybe mean that he could be pretty good as a wingback, that he runs very quickly, he runs a lot, he works hard defensively. But I feel like we now have a lot of players in similar positions and there isn't a role for everyone on this Juve 11.
You're going to upset Nicky with your 11 because you didn't mention Aaron Ramsey, of course.
Where's he going to play? With Chiesa coming in? You're going to say
with his injury record, I don't think he's going to play much. But anyway, right. No, look, I agree with you. I think it's about balance. I think Pirlo has been given... he's been given a lot of latitude. I think Juve realized, look, if we're going to change, if we're going to move from being sort of the reactive Allegri team that we've been in the past, we tried it last year with Sarri. It didn't work out, partly because, you know, Sarri kind of did things halfway and also the players didn't like him, didn't understand him. Let's get Pirlo. If Pirlo's terrible, he's not going to cost us very much, right? And it was, we said before, Pirlo makes less than, I think, every single Juve player except for Pinsolio. So, you know, at that stage, let's keep an open mind about this. That is the message, you know, from the club. And it's, look, as you know, Italy traditionally has generally been a pretty conservative country when it comes to our football. I can flag up issues with this too. Like, you know, you play a back three, he's played Chiellini and Bonucci in the first two games. Newsflash, those guys aren't going to last the whole season, right? Chiellini, Bonucci, Danilo, if you're going to play a back three, you need probably five or ideally six central defenders. Chiellini missed most of last season. Bonucci hasn't magically gotten any younger. Danilo's really a fullback and not a particularly good fullback at that. De Ligt is out until November, and while he's a phenomenal player, he's not the quickest player in the world. And then you have Demiral, who's very good, but okay, it's Demiral, right? It's just one guy. So I think he's going to have to work on that, work on the back three first and foremost, try to add some pace in there if he's going to continue with the back three. And then further up the pitch, he's going to figure it out. He's not, you know, we both read his thesis. He's not wed to formations as much as he is wed to ideas, what he wants to do with the triangles. He's got players who are very different, I think, between them, you know, from Dybala to Morata to Cristiano. And he's going to experiment and find the right combinations. And it's okay. They've won it 9 years in a row. They're giving him license to do this. Unless things really, really go south and all of a sudden, you know, they're in mid-table, I don't necessarily have a problem with what Juve are doing.
As for Napoli, they cannot be too upset with how theirs turned out. At the top of the show, Matteo picked overall his best signing in the Serie A in this window as Victor Osimhen, and he's definitely been a great addition to this team, hasn't he, Gab?
Yeah, he's been fantastic. Now, look, we're very early in. I think I'm right. I think he came on as a sub in the first game, and you know we want to see more of him. He's still very, very young, but he looks phenomenal thus far. I think, you know, we even saw Chucky Lozano coming out and contributing. I like the way Gattuso hasn't, you know, really cut players off unless we're talking about Milik, but that's probably for other reasons. I like the Bakayoko addition in midfield, you know, coming in at the end. You're talking about a guy who already has Serie A experience, a guy who I thought had a reasonable season last year at Monaco and is still young and can grow. I think Napoli looked good. I had my doubts about Gattuso when he took over, but he's proven me wrong. And yeah, Napoli are definitely contenders for the title. Koulibaly stuck around. I mean, what more do you want? I think Di Lorenzo is going to continue getting better. I think he kind of flew under the radar a little bit. I'm a big Fabián Ruiz fan. Deme's doing what he's supposed to be doing. Come on, man. This is good.
It's another anti-Juve. We've already added Atalanta as an anti-Juve on the show. Inter's the perennial anti-Juve. Now Napoli, who were really the anti-Juve of the last decade, challenging Juventus almost until the end. But I agree with you. I think Napoli have had a fantastic mercato. And what Gattuso's been able to do as well with Chucky Lozano, where basically Gattuso said that he didn't see the fire that he expects from his players behind the scenes. And now Lozano looks like one of Napoli's best players. And he's done this all while not playing in his best position, because on the Mexican national team at PSV, he was always a left winger. He was someone who was an inverted winger who liked to cut in onto his right foot. Under Ancelotti, played as a striker, as a right-sided striker. Now he's playing as a right winger, and he's figured it out all the while not being as a left winger, which is kind of difficult to do when you have Insigne, who's going to play there, and then Mertens, who can play there. So I'm with you. I wasn't sure about Gattuso, but he has really done well with the squad, and he's gotten the best out of some key players.
We want to add Lazio to the anti-Inters too, since they...
Do you know what? That's exactly where we'll end. Why would you add them?
Look, okay, the reason I would add Lazio is this. So they've hung on to all their stars. They haven't lost anybody, right? We all assumed that somebody would be sold, and for a bunch of different reasons, they haven't sold them. I know Simone Inzaghi looks like, you know, we have a term and my grandmother uses it, it's an Italian one, Matteo might get this, Pasqualotto, like he looks like kind of like, you know, the nice boy, the nice but dim boy from the village, right? You guys must have had, you know what I'm talking about. You must have had little villages up on Teesside where they were always like the nice polite
boy. My dad called me a different thing in Milanese, which I can't get into. It's not Disney friendly.
It reminds me of an old comedian, Harry Enfield, Tim Nice But Dim.
Exactly. But, you know, Simone Inzaghi's, he's proven everybody wrong. He's made this work. You know, when you look at, you know, you look at what he sends out there, what he sent out there last season with playing Luis Alberto, Milinkovic-Savic, Correa and Immobile at the same time, right? It wasn't that long ago that people in Italy says, oh, no, you can't have four attacking players at once on the pitch. What is this? No, balance. Don't give... You know, they counterattack well. I predicted every year that Ciro Immobile is going to drop off and isn't going to score 25 goals. And then he proves me wrong every single season. So I've given up on that. I said, go ahead, Ciro, go score your 20 goals this year. I don't see why they wouldn't be in the mix. Again, logic suggests they're going to drop off after last season, even though they've added depth and whatever. But they've been illogical all along. So let's put Lazio in the mix too.
I want to push back really quickly because I think post-lockdown, Gab, we saw the main weakness with Lazio, which they haven't really addressed in the transfer window, which is the lack of depth. Suddenly we had several injuries that if they strike Inter or Juve, it's not really a problem. But with Lazio, we saw a significant drop-off when they had some key players missing post-lockdown and they were playing three games a week and they had to rotate. And that, remember, they were, what, a point away from Juve when the post-lockdown
Serie A began? So if they tanked the Champions League, look, and they were also extremely lucky last year and look at expected goals and whatever, shouldn't have been there. But, you know, who knows? This is going to be such a weirdo season this year in so many different ways that – I'm not ruling anybody out. They're not my pick to win the title, but I do think Serie A this year has four or five legitimate contenders. I know you're not putting Milan in that mix because, you know, it's so Italian, isn't it, Kay? Like, oh, no, like, I don't want to jinx them.
Fatalista,
you know, but why not? You know, they're top of the table. They have as many points as Atalanta. Without Ibra.
Tune in next week. We'll add three more names to the anti-Juve list because it just keeps growing every week on Serie A. Awesome. Gab, great to hear from you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Worry not, Serie A fans. All was not lost in terms of entertainment just because Juve and Napoli didn't play. I mean, what more do you need than Atalanta playing anyone, anytime, anywhere? And I know Nikki Bandini loves to talk about Atalanta, so we're going to let her do it. Nikki, my question is are they better than ever?
Do you know, it feels like, I mean, they've already done something that's better than anyone ever, which is winning their first three games of the season, scoring at least four goals in all of them, which is pretty extraordinary. I know there's a sort of level to which you just get used to it. Like, you get used to seeing this happen every week. Atalanta are going to score all these goals. But it is ridiculous when you take a step back and realize that, yeah, no one's ever done that before to start a Serie A season. And I think I'm just, again, you've already hinted at it. Like, anyone who's listened to this podcast since we started knows that I was early on the bandwagon and I'm fairly obsessed anyway with Papu Gomez, the footballer. I think he's magnificent. I think in all of the talk that's going to happen around now when the transfer window's just shut about who the best signings were, I think Papu Gomez staying, not taking the money and heading off to Saudi Arabia, which looked like a possibility at one point, is better than any signing that anyone's going to make in Serie A probably all season. And you can not just sort of talk about this in general terms. I know he scored a couple of really great goals already this season. Go and look specifically at what's happened in the two games since we last recorded the podcast. The goal he scored this last weekend is part of a 15-pass, 11-player move, which basically starts, he's not the first pass, but one of the most critical passes in it is him coming back all the way to take a ball from the goalkeeper on the edge of the box, which he then spreads out to the left wing, gets up the pitch, and then it goes through the whole team, basically, before finding its way back to him to then pick out the corner from outside the box. So, you know, the finish on its own is already okay. How many players in the league can do that? But who in the league is doing that finish and also starting the move on the edge of their own box? And what I think is fascinating is actually, if you go back and look at the midweek game against Lazio, who they also steamrolled, by the way, a team supposed to be competing with them for a top four spot, it's a really similar situation building up to, I think, the third goal in that game, except that actually Gomez misplaces the initial pass. He's in the same spot. He's come back and he's receiving the ball with his, I mean, I say back to goal. He's so far away from the opposition goal, you don't even really think of it in that way. But yeah, he's facing his own goal. And he tries to play a quick pass out to the flank, but this time Luis Alberto's on it. It's not a great touch from Gomez, actually. And so he gives the ball away. But Luis Alberto's touch isn't great either. And the same sort of thing very quickly unfolds where suddenly they're up the other end and they're scoring. And it's all because you've got this sort of one dynamo who is tuttofare. He does everything. Like, he is everywhere on the pitch. He is malleable in the way that he does that because, again, to get into details, like, look at the start of the Lazio game, he was much more on the left-hand side. It wasn't working, and so he came into the middle. He's given that freedom, and he's one of the few players, I think, in any of the top leagues in Europe who uses that freedom just so effectively. I think he's brilliant. I can't get over how good he is.
On top of all of that, he's like the heart and soul of the team. You can see that off the pitch as well. He's just such a fun person to be around. He must be great to commentate on, Mateo.
He is. And as Nikki mentioned, keeping Papu Gomez and not letting him go to Saudi Arabia, it kind of reminds me of when Toto Di Natale stayed at Udinese all those seasons, where you're looking at a player who clearly could play for much bigger teams, even though I'd say Atalanta now, we're almost getting used to the fact that they could be a big team, even though we grew up with them as a provincial side bouncing from Serie B to Serie A consistently. But with Papu Gomez, he's even taken up a new role now. He's playing behind the strikers. He used to be a left winger who cut on to his right foot, but he can play more centrally now. And this is a scarier Atalanta. Just to go back to your original question to Nikki, this Atalanta team has more depth. We'll get into some of the players that they've brought in and analyze their summer mercato, but it's the players that they've been able to keep as well. They haven't really had any significant losses apart from Timothy Castagne, who was a rotational guy, right? Because they have Hans Hatebor and Robin Gosens as the two primary wingbacks, and they're able to get tenfold the money back for players that they bring in. But it's the players that they keep, and this is something that I feel like fans kind of forget sometimes. It's like, we didn't make any splash signings. Yeah, but you kept all of your stars and you gave them the contracts to make sure that they're staying at the club. And that's exactly what Atalanta are starting to do, which was never in their history. But when you have Champions League money coming in, it gives you a bit more freedom and flexibility of players that you're actually able to keep now.
Still one of the shrewdest sides, Nikki, in the transfer market for you in Italy?
Absolutely. I mean, Matteo's nailed it. Like, losing Castagne, fine. You know, they've gone through plenty of wing-back players in that mould. In the last few years, they've always done fine losing even starters, and he wasn't a starter. So in some ways, I think they are one of the teams that benefited most obviously, in a footballing sense, from the current climate of teams not really knowing how to spend their money, how much money to spend, what the financial outlook is for football. They're damaged like everyone is by the reality of the financial situation. But in a normal summer, after what they achieved, I think they would have lost more. I think they would have had more teams knocking on the door and trying to take pieces away, and they would have had to do more working around that. And they really haven't. They really haven't lost, again, exactly as Matteo said, almost anything that matters this summer. But even in previous summers when they have, they've always been very shrewd about it. They've always been very good at sort of filling the gaps. I think a lot of that is because it is a system. It is Gasperini's system that has elevated this team and made it something more. And I think that a lot of the pieces in it are ultimately quite replaceable. I think Papu Gomez is the one that's most clearly not. And I think you could look at a few others who are sort of individual talents who you won't necessarily get something like that again. I mean, Josip Ilicic, there aren't many Josip Ilicics around. At the same time, Ilicic missed a bunch of games and they were still fine, which shows you how strong the system is. And probably, I would argue, how important Papu is, because as long as he's there, I think a lot of things keep ticking over.
And Ilicic has been out. He's had some real issues during the pandemic. We hope that he gets better, and we hope to see him back on the pitch, because he was one of the most important players for Atalanta last season, really kind of brimming on world-class ability when he was playing. But to me, what Atalanta are doing on the pitch, it's like they're playing a different sport. And what they're doing in the summer transfer window is also playing a different sport altogether. The fact that, Nikki, they made 70 million euro roughly with two players that had absolutely no involvement, with Traoré going to Manchester United, with Kulusevski, who didn't play for Atalanta, he was on loan at Parma, going to Juve, but they got all the money from Parma, basically developing Kulusevski into a player that's worth all that money. And to think that they were able to do that with two players that had no involvement, and that they were able to bring in significant signings. I mean, Cristian Romero, who was once upon a time bought by Juventus but kept on loan at Genoa. This young kid, Sam Lammers, who, when they signed him, I thought, right, I've never heard of him. I'm going to go check him out. So I opened up Wyscout. I went and I looked at all of his touches and all of his involvements in previous games with PSV, because when Atalanta signs someone, you're thinking, right, what are they on to? What have they seen in this kid? And based on the footage, he looked incredible. The technique, the close control. And I remember sending out a tweet right away saying, watch out for Sam Lammers. Did you see the goal that he scored over the weekend? That brilliant footwork for someone who's 6'2". It feels like Atalanta, with their limited budget, the scouting network that they have, the youth system, are they here to stay as a mainstream team? Because it seems like we're going in this direction where suddenly they are a top four contender every single season.
I think, you know, you always, it's very hard for anyone in football to project 10 years ahead, say. I think if you looked 10 years back, you'd find heaps of things that weren't supposed to happen that have happened. And so that sort of question is very nebulous for me. I think, again, though, you come back to this topic of the shortened summer, the lack of sort of general disruption to the squad that might have otherwise happened. I think the momentum is significant. I think the momentum, not just in terms of what's happening on the pitch, but to an extent, maybe, I feel like Gab would kill me for this, but like some of what's happening off the pitch and how that feeds into the mood of a team and the atmosphere around a team. I mean, you look at it, they're going to home games with probably in the current climate, not the smartest idea, but, you know, squadrons of Vespas with flares riding down the street alongside them.
That was a great video.
And it's three games into the season. These are the sorts of scenes you normally see at the end of the season, when things are going great, when you're knocking on the door of achieving something special. The mood around this team is just buoyant, which is remarkable in a city that's gone through so much. I mean, Kay was talking about Gomez's sort of role as a leader within the team. And I think that, going back to that, I still have sort of fresh in my mind these images that his partner was sharing, his wife was sharing on Instagram, just completely empty streets, going to the pharmacy to get baby formula for their kid. And I think there is a real connection that exists between a lot of these players. I mean, Martin Jeroen's another great example of someone who's clearly connected with the fan base in a very particular way. And the people, the community that they play for want of a better way of putting it. And I think that is the sort of thing that could have faded over a long summer. A long summer would have given you time to lose some of that feeling. Things would have got more bogged down in the business side. The reality of football and what it normally is, which is a pretty cynical business, can take away from some of that. And I think Atalanta have it right now. And that's definitely to their benefit. To answer your actual question, again, 10 years from now, I don't know. I think money tends to tell in the long run. But I think this team is not going anywhere this season. I think they're... You know, 3 weeks in, I almost would sort of put them, I'd be surprised if they don't end up in the top four, put it that way.
Matteo said on his commentary call, and he cannot deny it, he said maybe they're the anti-Juve.
They could be. I feel like we're getting a lot of anti-Juves, but who's played better than them so far? And if it was just who's played better than them so far, fine, you dismiss it. But if you say who's played better than them so far, who played better than them away to Juventus in Turin late last season? Who's played better than them going back several months?
That's the thing, Nikki, is that it feels like Atalanta raised the level of their game based on their opposition. We saw this now for the last few seasons under Gasperini, the matches that they've had against Inter, against Juventus, against Milan, all the goals that they put past new Stefano Pioli's side back in December. This is a side that I was worried post-lockdown, how will they react without their fans there? Because it did seem, since Gasperini took over, that Atalanta were a different side when they played at home in Bergamo compared to when they traveled. At home, they had their best performances usually. The crowd was, I thought, the best 12th man in the league, and they didn't miss a beat post-lockdown. There was no one in the stadium. It was barren. There was hardly any noise, but they still played like the vintage Atalanta that we're now getting accustomed to. And I can't say enough about this team because it's not usual. You don't see this. This isn't supposed to happen in a game now that's dominated by money, where last season they had the same wage bill as a mid-table championship side in the English second division. This isn't supposed to happen. And I think this is why so many fans have latched on to their story, because it is the modern Cinderella story. And their run in the Champions League was magical after struggling in the group stage. It really has been one of the best Serie A stories and rides to be on of the last decade.
Okay, so that's Atalanta. But meanwhile, Milan are finally showing some identity. It's three straight wins in the Serie A. And beware this season if you need to face them in a penalty shootout, by the way, because we know how that could end. That was incredible.
That was insane. I've never seen anything like it against Real Ave.
Yeah, so obviously things go well for them in Europe as well. But Pioli said, Nikki, that they will encounter difficulties. And perhaps after the international break, we could see that, because that's set to be their truest test yet. The Derby della Madonnina against Inter, because so far it's great to see that they've been doing as well as they have, but you have to say it's against teams they should be doing better than.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what they've achieved so far is still notable. I mean, they fielded the youngest starting 11 against Spezia at the weekend of any team since Opta started keeping records in 2004, 2005. So that's already something to do that. Fields to Young team win 3-0. You know, they did have to bring on the grizzled 26-year-old Çalhanoğlu to unlock things in the end. But, I mean, we're talking about take Ibrahimović out of the team, and it is a very, very young core. I think some really interesting choices made by Pioli this week. It was Kessié Mbeumo who started in the Europa League game, which I would think of as your starting midfield. You bring them out on the weekend. You give Sandro Tonali, who we've been waiting to see, a start. I think the sort of... It's weird, because I was about to say the depth of the squad could be really significant, but is it like what we would conventionally think of as a deep squad? It's a lot of kids who you're putting a lot of faith in, but who are so far, as a collective at least, rewarding that faith. I didn't think Tonali had a great game. I think Lorenzo Colombo up front looks like he's a little bit outmatched for me, but then some of the others, like Brahim Diaz was, I mean, he's been really, really something. He's eye-catching so far.
Yeah, different class. Brahim Diaz, it's his touch. He still gets knocked over a bit. He still loses possession. But I think what Brahim Diaz has showed in the first few match days shows that he's a very exciting player with his touch. The ball's glued to his feet. I thought Tonali was actually the worst performer on the pitch. He gave away so many balls. I think he was trying to overcomplicate things. And it's a position where right now, Ismail Benacer is the better fit for Milan, and there aren't that many other spots for Tonali to take. That's not a problem. He's still so young. It's going to take time. But I received some pushback, Nikki, because I was showing a lot of excitement about Milan's start winning their first three games. They've been undefeated since post-lockdown. I think that's now 15 straight in Serie A where they haven't lost. And I was met with a response of, well, look at who they played this season. But I'm not buying that, because I've watched every single minute of Milan since the last Scudetto run, when Zlatan Ibrahimović was there, when Max Allegri was there. Milan in the last decade has struggled mightily against teams they should be beating and dominating. They've lost so many points every single season against the lower table sides, against the mid-table sides, teams that are fighting relegation. I think back to that goal by Brignoli of Benevento that stole points from Milan. This has been every single season a big problem. You don't go to the top four because you beat Inter and Juventus. You go to the top four, you can concede points to the top two. But if you get the business done against most of the other teams in Serie A that you should be beating, then you should end up in a Champions League position. So for Milan to be winning handily against teams like this, this is something new. And this is all without Zlatan Ibrahimović, who I credited as being the one who was giving a leadership, not in the traditional sense, but maybe terrifying his teammates around him into performing to their best.
Well, look, it's not just Ibrahimović. Ibrahimović, when he went out last season, we had this conversation, will they be able to find the goals like Ibrahimović? And suddenly Ante Rebic becomes this sort of prolific goal scorer that we didn't know he could be. Now you've lost Rebic as well. And hey, here's Rafael Leão stepping up and taking on a more sort of crucial role, I guess, in that element. I do think that if you want me to pick holes in this team, I don't feel fully sort of confident in looking at a team thinking there's enough strikers and there's enough goal scorers, but so far they've found them. They've kept three clean sheets. That's worth mentioning as well against these teams when you talk about making life complicated for yourself. This was a starting defense of Simon Kjær and Gabbia alongside him. This was not even Romagnoli at the back, you know, talking about grizzled veterans, Romagnoli, who's still hardly an old man and, you know, is a club captain and was also missing in this team. There was a lot of players missing, and it's a very confident win for a team that is that young, that is missing that many of these supposed leaders of the squad.
So the biggest test, as I mentioned, should be the one that's coming next against Inter. Is it a lopsided matchup this time around, Matteo?
Not as much as we've seen in recent seasons. I actually think that this is the best chance for Milan to steal points. We've yet to see Ibrahimović's condition. It seems like he's going to be back for the derby. That was put in question. Obviously, he tested positive now 2 weeks ago. So it seems like he should be back. But with this disease, you just never know. I think what Milan have shown, though, is finally a side that, yes, they're young, and this goes back to Ivan Gazidis and his vision for the club, which is buying under 25 players who can grow in value, who have their best years ahead of them. The only notable exception was Zlatan Ibrahimović, but he's kind of like a unicorn.
If Ibrahimović, he was 39 on his birthday.
But he's ageless, Kate. Right. Doesn't matter what age he is. He's Ibrahimović. The guy's going to score until he's 50 or even 100 if he wants to. But I think against Inter, they're not the favorites, but this is the best chance because it has been a very lopsided Derby della Madonnina in the last 5-6 seasons where Inter have basically picked up most of the wins. They have a better squad. They still have more depth. And more importantly, as Nicky was saying about the age factor, Milan fielding the youngest team since ages ago, Inter have players that are ready for the now, and Milan have a lot of players that were still yet to see them realizing their full potential. That was obviously part of the plan. But I still have Inter as the favorite, but definitely not as lopsided.
Yeah, I mean, Inter haven't been great. Like, leave aside the league table. They've played a much tougher game playing away to Lazio. But Lazio game was a great example for me of a game they should have won and didn't. And this is, I feel like an important test for them to go straight from that game into the derby. I think they need to win the derby to show they can win these important games. And I'm not as confident in them. I know you're going to talk to Mina about Inter, so I'll leave that to her. But I'm not as confident in Inter as I could be. I think it's going to be a really interesting derby.
Saturday, October 17th, it is the Derby della Madonnina between Milan and
Inter.
We're
doing that game on
ESPN
Plus.
You guys are doing that game on
ESPN Plus.
And next time we all reconvene on Serie Awesome, we'll be looking ahead to that game in more depth. But Nicky, great to hear from you. Speak to you again next week.
Take care, Nicky.
So how are the other side of the city looking after their first three games? I know Mina Rizuki has some thoughts on this. Not that we can really look at their last game to judge that by. But Mina, let's start by what Nikki said. It seems that she's not too positive about Inter's chances going into the derby. And I think that's coming as something of a surprise for you.
Yeah, I'm shocked by that because I'm always the person who's a little bit down on Inter and Antonio Conte. And I always feel like Nikki's like the nice one who's full of positive energy, who always chooses Inter as the Scudetto challengers. And definitely this year they're going to win it. Definitely this year they're going to take it from Juve. So I'm a little bit surprised by that. Also because as great as Milan have been, and it has been three wins, no goals conceded, it hasn't exactly been against teams that you can really accurately judge how they're doing. So I'm a little bit scared to be like, oh yeah, this is a strong Milan. It is Bologna, it is Spezia. Having said that, they have been without Rebic and without Zlatan Ibrahimovic. Meanwhile, Inter, everyone keeps talking about them. It wasn't a great performance against Lazio. I still think Antonio Conte doesn't really know what midfield to put out to ensure balance. And I think that until he figures that out, because it's either too defensive, too offensive like last time where they didn't have somebody that can actually possess the ball. But I think it's also his style of play. What they are missing, and I think it's so important, is they don't have a destroyer, but a pure destroyer in the sense of Kante and Makaleli, those types of players that we used to have and that he really wanted. But right now it seems like you can just stop them going out wide, force them to go through the middle, and you can stop them. And considering how Stefano Pioli managed to change the game for Milan over the weekend, how he just made tiny adjustments and all of a sudden Milan was such a strong team going forward with his tactical brain against Antonio Conte, who can be a bit predictable, maybe that's why she thinks it.
Yeah, we've definitely not seen the best version of Inter, right? Because the first few weeks we saw Alexander Kolarov as a center back. He's clearly not in the best 11 when everyone is healthy. I still think the best three at the back, Skriniar, De Vrij, and Bastoni, the youngster. And I still can't believe that Skriniar was on the transfer market. There was rumors that they were going to sell him. He had one season in a back three under Conte. He was at his best two seasons ago in a back four, where he played also in his previous life back before he joined Inter. But you need more time to adapt to a very different formation, to a very different role as well from what he's played in the past. But he was two seasons removed from being one of the top three center backs in all of Serie A, one of the best defenders in Europe. You need to keep that guy and allow him to figure out his best role in this back three. And then the midfield, like you mentioned, does Conte still know who the best midfield unit is? I'm not quite sure. I mean, we've seen Christian Eriksen. That still is not working out. If I had to play coach right now, I would say it would probably be Vidal, Sensi, and Barella as the three midfielders I would go with in a big game with Lautaro and Lukaku up front. So we haven't seen that unit at their full stride playing consistently yet. So there is that as a positive for Inter, is that they have so much depth and they have this ability to rotate and experiment, and they have so many quality players that are ready for the now, that are at their best right now, at a difference to Milan, where a lot of the players are young and they're still trying to figure out if they can realize their full potential or not.
Yeah, but there's also question marks in the sense over the coach and whether or not, you see, this is what I don't understand. You're playing, for example, against Lazio, and all of a sudden they did have Immobile sent off. This is the time to gamble. This is the time to realize your moments. You know, you don't need three centre-backs on Correa, basically. Why not double up? Throw in as many people as you can at that point and try to take the points. Why not when you realize that through the centre that, you know, you had one shot on goal in the first half, you really didn't have anything going forward. It was just delivering lots of balls to Romelu Lukaku, who wasn't even being delivered in a space and allowing him to really play. It was a case of look at what you have in your team. Try to have a player in the middle that understands vertical space, how to deliver for you forward. It should never have been Barella in the position that he was playing, to be honest. Never play without Brozovic or Sensi, one of them at least, in my opinion, or Eriksen if you want a little bit of creativity. But it's almost like they have a lot of good players, but they don't have a specialist as a defensive midfielder. They do have it in Eriksen, but he needs a lot of support. And I just think that relying all the time on the wide spaces with having so little going through the middle, they are so weak in the middle, defensively weak in the middle, attacking-wise they are weak in the middle. And that is what I have an issue with in the terms of how they're building their squad, because you can't have Perisic and Hakimi and then have a midfield that is either too attacking or full of raiders, basically, full of box-to-box players. That is the thing I have. And again, it's about judging the moment, knowing when to suffer, when to go forward, when to take risks. Stefano Pioli, for example, you know, with Milan, knows exactly when to do that, how to manage the moments. And that is what worries me with Antonio Conte, not just for the derby, but also going ahead and playing in the Champions League, because we've seen when they are in control, like they have been in Borussia Dortmund or against other teams, like against Lazio, can easily lose control because they don't have a midfield that knows how to control the tempo.
I think you could answer your own. I'm guessing your question about Conte was rhetorical, because you could easily answer that. We know who Conte is. He's been in our lives now for a very long time as a manager of one of the top sides in Serie A, whether it be Juventus or Inter. This isn't someone who is malleable as a manager, someone who's flexible with his tactics, and someone who's just going to see either an advantage where the other team goes down to 10 men, or maybe they're down a goal and change drastically. I think he lives and dies by his system, which ultimately is a defensive counterattacking system that has been picked apart sometimes as well in the Italian media, asking why, with all these weapons, sometimes you don't take more risks.
Yeah, absolutely. Or, I mean, I'm just, the question is can he evolve this? Because if you have a player like Sanchez who moves so beautifully in the final third, you know, is there a way that you can play him with Romelu Lukaku and with Lautaro Martinez?
For sure.
And make this a team that is a little bit unpredictable? Because right now, if I just stop the width of Inter, what are they going to do to me down the middle? Which is weird, because most teams, when you are playing against them, it's usually you try to force them out wide. Whereas with an Antonio Conte team, let's just force them to go through the middle and see what happens, because you feel like they won't really know what to do. So I'm interested whether or not he can ever create the side that's a little bit more unpredictable, that can stretch you, but that can also beat you through the middle with the beautiful football that Eriksen can produce, with possession, with players that can hold and control the tempo. And so when Lazio find their confidence, or when Milan find their confidence in that match upcoming, you know, upcoming match, he knows how to say, right, you guys start holding the ball. This is the time to suffer. This is the time to stand back, condense themselves, compress yourselves, and then go forward when you have a chance. That is really, I mean, what I want to see this season is not the fact that they have this wonderful midfield. I want to see whether or not he's evolving as a coach, whether or not he can make this midfield that is packed with so much talent capable of doing and playing unpredictable ways to defeat the opponent.
How would you rate their transfer business overall, Mina, when you look back at everything that we've seen Nainggolan staying put. Eriksen, there were rumours that maybe he could go. He's staying put now. And obviously, there's some parts that Antonio Conte is very happy about. But overall, what do you make of it?
To be honest, I do really like Inter as a team. I think that they are building themselves up as a club. I feel like Steven Zhang being there all the time, being able to communicate with Antonio Conte, implicates him at times that he needs to. I think that, you know, his decision to not let Nainggolan go because he doesn't want to devalue any assets. You know, this is how much I paid. This is how much I expect. I don't want anyone to sort of, you know, look at us and think that we'll just give away our players for free. I think that's something that's very important when you're trying to build a brand. And I think when it comes to the way that they are communicating, buying players like Ashraf Hakimi, looking at the midfielders they are bringing in, I'll always trust Pepe Marotta when it comes to negotiations. My only issue is that with this is, like, if you look at the fact that Milan is, what, the youngest team in Serie A, when you look at Juventus trying to lower the average age, I want Inter to continue in the thread of believing in youngsters like they did in Barella and Sensi and Ashraf Hakimi. I don't like the idea of going for players like Arturo Vidal. We spoke about him in the beginning, and there, lo and behold, against Lazio, I didn't think he offered anything when it came to vital experience and you know, a man that you want on that pitch, the leadership that everyone talks about, I think is a liability in all truth. And so I want them to focus more on the kids. I want Sensi to be playing as much as possible, and so that he can take out these silly mistakes of being sent off because he made an emotional decision, and focus on that. And who else? Honestly, Antonio Conte is known to develop players. So give him these guys. I know he likes the oldies and the veterans, but try to work with the kids.
Could you imagine if we had the 2015 version of Vidal and Nainggolan, how incredible that team would be? It would be like you're playing with 13 players, the way that those two ran in their primes and all that they can offer box to box. But to go back to Kay's question, I think overall it was a very solid transfer window for the fact that Ashraf Hakimi came in, and much better than previous iterations of the transfer market. I mean, they gave away Nicolò Zaniolo basically for free. They sent him on with Davide Santon and money for Raja Nainggolan. So they didn't make any howlers like that, except maybe Sandro Tonali not coming instead of Nainggolan. But I think that Hakimi was a big signing. They've added depth. They've added players who are fine for the now, who are fine to win this season, right, which is ultimately the big goal.
With all the things that they have, they've got a lot of good players that know how to absorb instruction and give Antonio Conte what they want. But do you really think they have players who are tactically the most intelligent? You know how when you look at, for example, how Germany won the World Cup, you can look at Sami Khedira and you look at Toni Kroos, you know, and then you could just think it doesn't matter what they have. You know, going forward in the players that they have, I don't find somebody there who is an Andrea Pirlo. I find them all to be almost an Antonio Conte. People that want to work hard, that follow instructions, that absorb everything and give you everything. But I'm not entirely sure that they know how to manage the moments. And unless he learns that, the team seems to me still to be one that's going to always be naive going forward. They haven't got an Andrea Pirlo, you know, somebody who knows how to control the tempo, or even an attacker who, like a Carlos Tevez was, for example, you know, somebody who understands the moments, knows when to go forward, knows how to help Alvaro Morata because he's younger than him. Romelu Lukaku is wonderful in the sense that he wants to help everyone on the team, but not necessarily somebody that on a tactical level will say, right, I'm Zlatan, I know how to push this team forward and I know when to suffer or whatever it is. I'm not sure that they have that player, so Conte's got to cover up for a lot of that.
So a theme running throughout this podcast has also been about players that they've managed to keep hold of that maybe earlier in the transfer window or even before it opened, we were wondering whether they would be moving on. And one of those players is Lautaro Martinez. And that has to be seen as a good thing, as a positive thing. And now the talk is how they can renew that contract, how they can better that contract, because it's said that he wants to be on the higher earners role. And you can understand that he's sticking around. How do you think they're going to manage that situation, Mina?
I think that Pepe Marotta is somebody who will always try to help you. If you don't want to be in the club, he will help you find your new destination. But if you want to stay, then he will try to find a middle ground for you so that you're happy. I also think it's important to not start doing things the way that Juventus have recently or the way that Barcelona have always done, which is just start giving really huge salaries. You know, he is still young and he had a good season under Spalletti, fine. He was amazing under Antonio Conte, but it's not like he's been doing this day in and day out and the person to rely on, because he wasn't that great after lockdown, to be honest. A lot of times, psychologically, things started to get to him. And he needs to, I think, to make him a better player, you also need to state the fact that, you know, he's not a superstar quite yet. I still think there is going to be the moment that he is going to want to leave, because it's very difficult to say no to a big Spanish club in the sense of Real Madrid or Barcelona. But right now, satisfy what you can with him. But it's amazing that they have Sanchez, because I think that he offers something completely different to Martinez, and alongside Lukaku can be somebody else that you can rely on if Lautaro's not always at his best.
Yeah, it's interesting with Lautaro because the report I saw in Corriere said, and it's pretty much echoing what you're mentioning, is that they'll slowly take him up to those higher pay levels rather than just giving him all that money straight away. And yeah. That's what they'll look like with the next contract. So that would be well managed by the club, by the board. But it is a great keep to keep hold of a player like this, especially with the connection that he's had and found with Romelu Lukaku.
With Inter's objectives and Zhang, the owner, and what they want to achieve with this club, which is bringing it back to the elites of Europe, you need to keep a player like Lautaro Martinez there. And a lot of times fans will say, we didn't get that big signing this window. But look at Lazio, for example. They keep their biggest stars. They don't sign anyone else. But still, you keep who you have that is attracting a lot of interest from other teams. Lautaro Martinez attracted plenty of interest, obviously, from Barcelona. I think he could start at almost any club in Europe because of how good he is, because of his pace, his technique, his shooting ability. He is the complete striker. I feel like he can go on to be a truly world-class number nine in that higher echelon of strikers. Truly brimming with world-class talent. You have to keep players like that if your objectives are a certain way, which are what Inter want to do. They want to win absolutely everything. They want to challenge for the Scudetto. They want to go all the way in the Champions League. If you give away Lautaro, what kind of message is that sending? That, right, we're going to give away our best young player, but yet we're saying that we want to go and achieve all these things. It's a contradiction.
But I'm also worried in the sense of when it comes to his development. I think that where he is right now, he feels very settled. And I am glad that he has somebody like Lukaku next to him. But sometimes when you do have players that are so equipped with, I mean, this was being spoken about Thomas Partey and Arsenal, going from a Cholo Simeone side to now being, you know, with Arteta, who might let him sort of indulge a little bit in his technique, in the beauty of his game. This is the thing with Lautaro Martinez. There's going to be a time where he wants a little bit more freedom, where he doesn't want to follow such a strong tactical discipline and that kind of plan that Antonio Conte puts together, and just be allowed to indulge in the luxury in finding the chemistry with a Lionel Messi or whoever it is that it would be playing in one of those clubs at that time. And so that is my fear when it comes to these super luxurious, technically gifted players, is that eventually they're going to want to break free and find themselves a place where they can really indulge in what it is that they have to offer. But right now, where he is, I do think that he needs to learn and to grow slowly. And I think he's surrounded by a club that's offering all the support that he needs right now.
Yes, so far, so good for Inter. And we will get some more answers after the international break is done and we see them up against Milan. And that's a game, as we mentioned, we will be looking ahead to next time we all meet on Serie Awesome. Mina, great to hear from you as always.
Thank you.
So before we do say goodbye, there are a few other notable transfers that I would like to bring up that haven't been mentioned throughout the show, at least in depth anyway. One of them, Chris Smalling, a.k.a. Smaldini, back to Roma.
Needed to be back to Roma. He wanted to be back in Rome. He had one of his best seasons of his career playing at Roma under Paolo Fonseca. And Paolo Fonseca made it known that he desperately needed another center back and he wanted Chris Smalling there. He's a starter. He's coming off a great season. And I'm glad that both Roma and Manchester United got this deal done because both parties should be happier now.
Meanwhile, the negotiations must have been really tough to get Gerard Deulofeu to Udinese.
Yeah, same owner. The Pozzo family, Deulofeu. I'm not sure how the negotiations work for that, but a player that has Serie A experience with Milan, very quick player who can beat players off the dribble. And I actually have very good memories of Deulofeu when he was a Rossonero, and I think he's going to be a huge signing for Udinese, a team that is basically just trying to get to that 40-point mark and avoid relegation.
So there are two more players that you have to look out for this season once Serie A returns after the international break. We'll be doing so too. Thanks for listening today. This is Serie Awesome. We'll speak to you next time.